The sixth and final case, the United States versus Paulus. Mr. Gimbel.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Your Honors.
Good to see you in court.
It's nice to see you as well. Joe Paulus didn't catch luck with respect to the timing of the resolution of his very bad behavior. As you have seen in the briefs in this matter, Mr. Paulus, through myself as his lawyer and counsel for the Public Integrity Section of the Department of Justice, negotiated a very particularized plea agreement in March of the year 2004. And pursuant to that plea agreement, he appeared before Judge Griesbach in Green Bay in April of 2004. Now, as you well know, having been repeatedly told, that thereafter several things happened in the arena of sentencing. The first thing that happened was that the Supreme Court said in Blakely that those considerations that might give rise to a court increasing or enhancing a sentence under the guidelines ought to permit the person who is affected by those enhancements to confront the information from which a judge could make those enhancements and do that with a criminal burden of proof. Thereafter, this court applied Blakely to the federal sentencing guidelines in Seventh Circuit Booker, also a case that was decided after Mr. Paulus entered into this very specifically articulated plea agreement and after he entered his plea. If you look at the plea agreement, you're going to find that this contract between Mr. Paulus and the government directed in paragraph 13 that the sentence to be imposed in the case would, in fact, be pursuant to the sentencing guidelines. And thereafter, in paragraphs 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, and 23, it articulates essentially how the guidelines should be applied to him. Now, prior to the time that this case came on for sentencing, about 3 days prior, Judge Griesbach, sua sponte, advised both parties that he was considering an upward departure in the case and invited the parties to tell him to what effect they thought that would be inappropriate. The government, honorably and consistent with their commitment in the plea agreement, declined to answer the judge because they had specifically indicated in the plea agreement that they would not make a motion for an upward departure in the case. I asked the court for some short additional time to respond to the court and did respond in writing to the court in advance of the then adjourned sentencing date, telling the judge that it was at least Mr. Paulus's view as I saw it that the court didn't have the authority to enhance his sentence as articulated in the plea agreement because of the fact that Blakely and Seventh Circuit Booker had required that the kinds of factors that would support an enhancement couldn't be discerned. In as much as the government, who would normally preside at a jury trial to present enhancing factual circumstances, was neutered out by their contractual obligations. Judge Griesbach asserted as a part of his underlying sentence, within which he departed upward by five levels and added almost twice the sentence that was called for in the plea agreement, said that the plea agreement itself was a document within which Mr. Paulus had conceded the factual circumstances that would permit him to have essentially the kind of a foundation under Blakely and Seventh Circuit Booker to make findings that he had admitted. Our position here today and our position to him then was that that shouldn't be so, in as much as it is typically the goal of defendants who negotiate a deal before they enter a plea to make some kind of recognizable concession that the facts support the plea that they're asking the court to accept. And that's essentially what Paulus was doing on the advice of his lawyer, even though he himself was a lawyer very knowledgeable about how the criminal justice system worked. I suggest to this court today that one thing that this court might include in a decision in this case is whether or not this court agrees with that concept that you can't take what I consider to be a pro forma concession that the prosecution can prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt and make that an admission that creates a foundation from which enhancements can be found as a factual predicate for the enhancement that Judge Griesbach did.
What actually occurred in the there was a recitation of the facts that the government could prove?
Yes, sir. Yes, Judge King.
And were those did those delineate the number of and amounts of bribery, 22 or whatever?
Yes, it did. Mm-hmm. What it did is we had the plea agreement, which articulated the terms of the contract between the government and the defense. And then it alluded to a factual statement, which was an auxiliary document within which those particular facts were articulated. And in the plea agreement, it said that we agree that the government can prove the facts in the attached statement of facts beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, where I think Judge Griesbach gets into mischief with respect to this sentencing is he writes a very thoughtful sentencing memorandum, and he articulates a very thoughtful sentencing predicate for the escalation of the guidelines that are articulated in the plea agreement. But within that, and I direct your particular attention to his sentencing decision, and in particular appendix pages 118 through 120. What Judge Griesbach does, which I suggest to you today, sets the stage for your sending this case back, vacating this sentence, and asking him to start over again, is he attempts, in my view, and you make your own decision about this, he attempts to support the basis for upward departure under the guidelines, although he says he's going to treat the sentencing as a Crockford non-guidelines case, pre-guidelines case, by a couple of recitations, both of which he says, I really can't consider this, but nonetheless he includes it in his sentencing justification, one of which is a statement within the pre-sentence report which articulates that contemporaneously with this prosecution, the state attorney general is engaged in kind of an overriding investigation of what might otherwise be out there under the tenure of Paulus's regime. And there's reference, and you'll see it in the appendix and in the articulations of Judge Griesbach, there's reference to the fact that there may have been 32 cases of bribery or other wrongdoing. That's in the pre-sentence. There was no factual concession of any other wrongdoing in this case. And what the facts really showed in the factual underpinnings of the plea agreement were that Paulus and a lawyer, a single lawyer who went to work for him subsequently, had a deal going, and the deal was that this lawyer would get preferential treatment and would split his fees with Paulus. And that happened on 22 occasions, and Paulus's share of the fees were something just less than $50,000. The comment in the pre-sentence report that's included in Judge Griesbach's sentencing memorandum goes on at great length to talk about the vastness of the state investigation in this matter. He then goes on, and in this same area, to allude to materials that were sent to him by various and sundry people, which were made available to us, including a newspaper article from a Madison, Wisconsin newspaper, and he alludes to that in the appendix 119, page 13 of his sentencing memorandum. C.D. Hall, did Paulus cheat to get convictions? And there is this postulation that somehow those people who are in jail, who were prosecuted by Paulus, may have claims that the cases that he prosecuted weren't done on an up-and-up basis as an outgrowth of the fact that he admitted to accepting bribes for these enumerated cases, which were by and large drunk driving cases. It seems that what then Judge Griesbach does is he anchors his enhancement of the effect on the administration of justice in the state of Wisconsin on both the state investigation and the postulation in this newspaper article letters that he wrote, which I suggest to this court undercuts the basis of Blakely and Booker of the Seventh Circuit, and I will return for my rebuttal.
At the court's leave, Mr. Kimball.
At the court's leave. Yes. Thank you very much. Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm out.
You're
I'm
out
sorry.
Of, no, you're out of time.
I see the red. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Salem.
Good morning, Your Honors. The 58-month sentence that Judge Griesbach imposed in this case was reasonable under Booker, and it should be affirmed. Using Booker's framework, the court performed a detailed guidelines analysis and it then looked to the factors set forth in 18 U.S.C. section 3553A in crafting its sentence. The judge exercised his discretion in departing upward, and that exercise was reasonable, and it was appropriately based on the defendant's status as the chief law enforcement officer of Winnebago County, Wisconsin, the number of bribes the defendant took and their amount, and the resulting public harm. Judge Griesbach made crystal clear in his decision that he was using the guidelines as a guide as opposed to a mandate, and that's exactly what Booker commands. He was aware of the discretion he had, and he exercised that discretion reasonably. And to the extent there was any error here, and we submit that there was none, that error was plainly harmless, as the judge would impose the same sentence on remand. The defendant's constitutional rights were not violated. There's no Sixth Amendment violation because the defendant admitted in his factual proffer to the facts upon which the judge based his departure. Nor did the court violate the defendant's due process rights because the law never capped the defendant's sentence at 33 months, not in 2000 at the time his criminal conduct ended, not in 2004 after Blakely, not in 2005 after Booker. In other words, at any of those time periods, Judge Griesbach could have conducted the exact same analysis he did, and he had the discretion to impose the exact same sentence he did. The defendant doesn't have a right to rely on law that never, in fact, existed. The defendant acknowledged in his plea agreement, he acknowledged directly to the court during his colloquy, that Judge Griesbach could sentence him to a sentence higher than that agreed on by the parties. And indeed, the defendant acknowledged that the judge could depart upward. The judge did exactly that, and that exercise of discretion was sound. Let me directly address a couple of points that the appellant...
Let me ask you, under Rule 11, you could have tied the judge's hands, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And this was not an 11C1C plea. And had the defendant negotiated that plea, we may be in a different posture here. But the defendant knew and acknowledged repeatedly, again, in the plea agreement and directly to the judge during the colloquy, that the judge had discretion to go outside of the range agreed to by the parties. Indeed, the judge noted during the sentencing hearing that he wouldn't be doing his job if he were simply a rubber stamp for the parties. Now, the appellant talks about the April 2004 plea, and again, it was not an 11C1C plea, so the judge was not bound. Paragraph 24 of that plea agreement states that the defendant had no right to be sentenced within a particular range. In addition, the defense counsel acknowledged at that very sentencing hearing that it was within the judge's authority before Blakely and Booker to depart upward. Clearly, it's within the judge's authority now.
What was the maximum penalty under this statute?
It was a five-year statute for the Travel Act, Your Honor, and 3 years for the tax offense, which would be 96 months if they were stacked. Now, the appellant alludes to some mischief engaged in by the district court judge in this case, and he passes over the entire discussion, detailed discussion of both the guidelines and his basis, the judge's basis for the upward departure, and jumps right to basically what amounts to an afterthought by the judge, which is a discussion of the state AG investigation. Your Honors, it's very clear from the voluminous opinion. Not only did the judge specifically say that his consideration of this state AG investigation was limited, But he said even in its absence, he's entitled to take judicial notice of the fact that there was public harm stemming from these crimes. And Schenberg, the court in Schenberg, specifically notes that. This did not involve just a relationship between a corrupt district attorney and a lawyer. It involved 22 separate cases with 22 separate defendants over a more than two-year period. And as the judge pointed out, the DA in this case, Mr. Paulus, sold out the justice system. And it was hard for the judge to conceive of a more deplorable kind of corruption than what happened in this case. And indeed, outside of the national security context, it is harder to think of a more repugnant form of corruption than an elected DA selling cases. So we would submit that the judge did not inappropriately rely on the state AG investigation in crafting his departure. That was just one small factor that the judge specifically said he did not fundamentally rely on. The judge did address all of the 3553A factors, so it cannot be said that he didn't follow the exact guidelines of Booker. The judge in this case had the foresight to anticipate that the guidelines would be advisory as opposed to mandatory, and therefore he looked at a broad range of factors in crafting the sentence. I want to be very clear that the government's position is that there is absolutely no basis, if there were to be a remand in this case, we don't believe one is warranted, for the sentence to be capped at 33 months. Indeed, this court's recent decision in Goldberg makes clear that a judge would in fact be free to go higher on remand, which seems to blow out of the water any argument that there's a 33-month cap. Again, all of the court's cases since Booker, the Supreme Court case of Booker was decided in this circuit, make clear that harmless error does apply in these cases. But we believe that this case involving the defendant is an even stronger case for affirmance than cases such as George and Lee and Goldberg. Because again, in this case, the judge recognized the discretion that he had and he exercised that discretion. He would do the same on remand and impose the same sentence, and therefore no remand is necessary because no prejudice attached. If there are no questions from the court, I'll conclude.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Solomon.
Thank you.
Mr. Gimbel, though your time has expired, you may have a minute.
Oh, I'd like to thank you very kindly. I do appreciate it. So, Mr. Paulus, I'll tell you that.
Judge Kaney, in his dissent in Palladino, would probably disagree with Mr. Solomon that this case, which clearly falls into those cases where reasonableness is an issue, and it shouldn't be one that's handled in an exchange of mail between this court and a trial court. It ought to be one where the person whose right and time is affected ought to have an articulable ability to express himself or herself, and I suggest that's true. Reasonable through the eyes of the government ain't the same as reasonable through the eyes of Mr. Paulus and his lawyer. And I suggest to you that in the same decision, this very long and well-articulated decision of Judge Griesbach, which he calls a sentencing memorandum, he agrees with me on page 14 or appendix page 120 that there's some merit to my argument that what he was doing was making subjective findings on this issue that he suggests underpins his ability to take this case up to 2 months short of the maximum, and I'll take my chances on remand if he wants to go higher, to go 2 months more, as the court indicated in Goldberg. I don't think he will, and I think Mr. Paulus, in light of the circumstance, the total circumstances and the timing of this case, ought to have a resentencing, and I urge you to do that. Thank you kindly.
Thank you, Mr. Gimbel. Thank you, Mr. Solomon. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.